Wadey appeared at the door, staring suspiciously into the darkness. Jeff made himself so small and flat along the ground that a cabbage leaf would almost have covered him. Wadey looked and listened and sniffed the night air carefully. Then he went back inside. Soon Jeff heard the sharp, clear notes of a flute blown by Boudinot coming from the tent, and his nose caught the odor of tobacco smoke from Wadey's pipe. He was still scared an hour later when he ran into Hooley back at the sentry post. He learned from Hooley that Boudinot, a nephew of Wadey's, had gone to college in the East and was now the Cherokee delegate to the Confederate Congress in Richmond, Virginia. He wondered what Wadey would do with the $45,000 in rebel banknotes Boudinot had brought from Richmond. He found out next afternoon. At 4 o'clock, they were mustered for pay. It was the first pay muster in 2 years, Hooley said. After a review and inspection, Boudinot himself acted as paymaster. Most of the money he had brought, Wadey ordered spent to relieve the needs of the destitute rebel refugee families. But each trooper received a month's salary, too. Jeff looked curiously at the crisp, new green banknotes, 2 fives and 5 ones. "Know what I'm going to buy first?" Jeff said to Hooley later. "There's a man selling ginger cakes up the street. I'm going to buy me a whole dollar's worth. Come on, Hooley. I'll buy you a chunk, too." Promptly they found the vendor. He was a big, bare-headed fellow who had built himself an oven in the hillside next to the town blacksmith. He was standing behind a 3-foot square of freshly baked brown gingerbread, fanning the flies off it with one hand. The hot, sweet smell was overpowering. Jeff slid off Fleabite. "Give us a dollar's worth of that," Jeff said, waving his $1 bill proudly. The vendor extended his dirty hand, plucked the banknote away, laid it on the square of gingerbread, and, cutting around it neatly with his bowie knife, hewed off a piece exactly the size of the banknote and handed it to the surprised Jeff. Then he pocketed the bill. Thus, Jeff learned for the first time of the weak buying power of Confederate paper money. Hooley laughed uproariously as Jeff broke off half his small piece and handed it to him. Jeff grinned ruefully. "I guess that's what Pa meant when he told me once that money is the measure of value." It was April of 1864, and the war, which had one more year to run, was raging with the convulsive fury of a final struggle. On the day before the Wadey Brigade left on its spring campaign, Jeff was still trying to learn the name of the Federal betrayer. For a whole month he sought vainly to get a personal description of the Federal officer who had smuggled in the dozen rifles, but he couldn't find anybody who had seen him. Pretending the firearms were his hobby, he talked about them with almost everybody he met, starting the conversation on pistols and revolvers, and then diverting it to the new repeating rifles. After weeks of the most persistent effort, he was able to locate 5 of the dozen repeating rifles Wadey had bought. They were Spencer's, like Orff's. But when he questioned the men who possessed them, each a crack sharpshooter, they could tell him nothing more. There were other reasons, too, for delaying his return to Fort Gibson. Reasons that were growing on him despite his Union background. When Jeff thought of them, he felt uneasy. And yet he couldn't help thinking about them. Just as he liked the Washburns and the Jackmans, he found himself liking the Wadey outfit more and more each day. The Wadey men weren't fighting a war over slavery. Both the Union and rebel Cherokees owned slaves. Nor were they fighting to break up the Union. Neither Cherokee faction belonged to the United States. Consequently, they had little interest in dividing it or keeping it intact. Among the Cherokees, the Civil War was mostly a political fight. The Wadey Bunch was fighting to keep the rival Ross Party from planting its foot on their necks. Jeff had never seen men who got so much fun out of doing their hard, rough jobs. He liked the informal way they waged a war. There weren't any Clardies among their officers. "If I wasn't fighting to hold the Union together and clean up the border trouble in Kansas, I could change sides mighty quick in this war," he thought. The weighty men fought well. They ate well, too. The Union salt horse and hardtack was a poor substitute for Heifer's Dutch oven T-bones and roasted sweet potatoes. Besides, the lonely rebel cook lavished delicacies upon Jeff that the other rebels never saw. Hot sourdoughs 6 inches high when the wheat flour came up from Texas, or wild grape cobbler, or a mess of fried eggs when he could get them from some Choctaw farm wife. He'd miss Heifer's cooking when he made the break for Fort Gibson. And he'd miss Heifer, too. Hardly a day passed but that Heifer tried to make Jeff a better soldier.
"Let me learn you some of my experience," the rebel cook said.
He taught Jeff how to squeeze the trigger of a shotgun with both eyes open and the gun swinging on the moving target. He taught him to ride a horse, steering with his legs, knees, and the balance of his body without putting pressure on the horse's mouth. He even took time to give Jeff advice on how to get along with everybody.
"Treat everybody like a gentleman, but let the ivory handle of your revolver always be in sight," Heifer counseled.
Jeff dreaded accompanying the weighty men on their savage raiding expeditions, but when he questioned Hooley cautiously about it, Hooley threw back his black head and laughed soundlessly.
"What would we raid now? Weighty's already stripped the whole country clean as a gut. There's nothing left to raid."
Jeff was amazed at the endless variety of the weighty cavalry dashes. On their first scout in 1864, they penetrated 70 miles behind the Union lines, almost to the state of Missouri, to bring out in baggage wagons several Cherokee rebel families, old men, women, and children, who had been robbed and plundered by the Pins. And they never saw a single Union soldier. Weighty's men harassed the Federals with their bold cavalry forays along the western border of Arkansas, vanishing into the timber or melting into the river mists before a large force could be sent to intercept them. Fields still used Jeff as a horse holder, so he was never put to the ordeal of having to fire on his own troops. But he saw it all anyhow. He was with the Weighty outfit in April when, as a part of General S.B. Maxey's force, they took a Federal wagon train at Poison Springs near Camden. He was with them again when they chased a small Federal force off the Massard Prairie into the protection of Fort Smith, falling back across the Poteau River with the Union horses, mules, and camp equipage they had captured. He rode and ate and slept with the Weighty outfit, sharing the hardships and dangers that bind fighting men inexorably together. Each day he became more and more impressed with the fierce loyalty of the Cherokee rebels to their cause. At Limestone Prairie in June, their enlistment period terminating, the entire Weighty force re-enlisted for the duration of the war, be it long or short. Jeff had to walk right up with Heifer and Hooley and sign the re-enlistment papers, too. A month earlier, he had seen the 1st and 2nd Cherokee regiments, forming with fife and drum, march around and around Weighty's tent, whooping and cheering until their throats became raw, when Weighty's commission as a brigadier general, signed personally by President Jefferson Davis, arrived by courier. Later, he was with them at Camp Brassey, when Weighty, addressing the rebel Cherokees in National Council, declared that the war should be prosecuted with the greatest vigor and recommended conscription of all physically fit Cherokees between the ages of 18 and 45. Not only did the rebel council give him what he wanted, they went even further. When they passed the act, they set the age limits at 17 and 50. Jeff thought, these people are in this war for keeps, and if they get those 1,000 repeating rifles, they might win back the whole of the Indian country in 3 short months. Early in June, the spring rains set in, and the Arkansas River began to rise. 3 days later, the cavalry was issued 5 days' rations and told to be ready to ride on an hour's notice. Swollen by heavy rains, the river had become navigable for steamers of light draft. The rebels learned that a Union steamer carrying a $120,000 cargo from Fort Smith to Fort Gibson for the Union soldiers and refugees there was on its way. Wadey and his command rode secretly from Johnson Station on the Fort Smith Road to Pheasant Bluff, a high-timbered spot overlooking the river channel where the steamer would have to approach. Next morning, Wadey concealed his cavalry beneath the trees and posted three pieces of artillery halfway up the bluff. Jeff, mounted on Fleabite, lay hidden with the Wadey horsemen in the cane along the river's south shore. Although the heavy brush and trees masked them, they could see the river plainly. Soon, Jeff heard a sound he had never heard before. The steady slap, slap, slap of a large paddle wheel. Suddenly, a boat nosed around the river bend, a large boat with two tall chimneys bellowing black smoke, and a Union flag whipping gallantly from the jackstaff. Disturbed, Jeff thought that if he ever decided to stay permanently with the rebels, he'd have to get used to riding against that flag. The Federal steamboat came on, heavily laden with the cargo Wadey wanted. It rode low in the muddy water, the white foam from its paddle wheel flashing in the morning sunshine. It was a long boat with a fancy pilot house and a white cabin. In evenly spaced letters of bright blue, Jeff could see the name J.R. Williams printed across the front of the small cupola atop the craft. And then he saw something else, something that sent a chill coursing down his spine. Blue-clad Union soldiers with muskets in their hands swarmed behind barricades of cotton bales on the deck. Apparently, this boat expected trouble and didn't intend to take it lying down. Chapter 22. Pheasant Bluff. Jeff tightened his grip on Fleabite's reins. The cannon would start firing at any moment, and when they did, every horse in the rebel outfit would try to climb the bluff or jump into the flooded river. It would be no picnic trying to board an armed boat from a swimming horse. He knew the Union escort, protected by the cotton bales, could pick them off neatly, or thrust them through with their sharp bayonets. What an odd way to die, killed by your own countrymen, as Bostwick had been at Honey Springs. A drop of sweat ran down the bridge of his nose. Nervously, he wiped it off with his sleeve and looked at the man on his right. His mouth fell open. The man on his right was Heifer Hobbs. Astraddle his roan, the rebel cook had deserted his pots and ovens and was standing in his stirrups, squinting through the willow leaves at the approaching boat. In crude leather holsters in his belt, he carried both his fighting knife, a bowie, and his eating knife, an old case blade of lead. His muzzle-loading double-barreled shotgun, souvenir of the Comanche Wars, was clenched tightly in his hands. He looked at Jeff, and his ugly face broke into a hideous grin of affection. Touched, Jeff knew now why Heifer had left his commissary wagon to fight at his side in what was to be Jeff's first battle with the Wadey men in a role other than a horse holder. Heifer's feeling for him was like that of a doting father. Heifer had poured out upon him all the fond attention he would have lavished on his own son, had not the lad he sent east to school disavowed him because of his deformities. Moved by the rebel cook's devotion, Jeff squirmed in torment. Here was a friend who would die for him, one he would wound deeply if he ever ran off to Fort Gibson. And yet, Jeff knew the time was coming when he would have to run or stay. Blam! The middle gun on the bluff roared so closely that it deafened him. Fleabite reared, neighing in terror, and the tree branches scraped off Jeff's hat. He muscled her down. A small geyser of water rose brightly 10 feet off the boat's bow and hung suspended in the morning air. An instant later, there came the kerplunk of the ball plowing into the muddy river and a loud, prolonged splash. Blam! Blam! Thundered the other two guns, higher on the densely wooded slope. One of the steamer's tall stacks had been shot away and black smoke was pouring into the windows of the pilot house. The fourth shot scored a direct hit, puncturing the boiler and causing the boat to list out of control, toward the opposite bank. The thin, clear notes of a bugle floated down from high along the bluff, sounding a charge. With a mighty shout, the long line of rebel cavalry burst from hiding and rode pell-mell into the muddy shallows of the Arkansas, spattering water 6 feet high. Finding that it relieved his nervousness, Jeff yelled as shrilly as the rest. Fleabite was in the vanguard, and as she encountered a deep spot, he felt the cool water rise to his armpits. She began to swim, striking out strongly. The heads of hundreds of horses and men bobbed on the surface, their bodies entirely beneath the water. Heifer stuck close by. Brandishing his shotgun, he gobbled encouragement to his mount. Every rebel in the river was steering his swimming horse toward the boat. The Union pilot swung on the whistle cord, hoping to attract help from any Union cavalry patrol north of the river. The whistle started on a single note, then slid into a deep, hoarse, three-toned blast that made Jeff's eardrums throb and echoed off the nearby bluff. But it didn't stop the weighty men. The pilot ran the crippled boat aground on a sandbar. Leaping over the side, the Union soldiers hurried to the north bank of the stream and scattered into the woods. The weighty men waded their ponies alongside the stranded steamer. Clambering over the side, they bored into the stricken boat like hungry squirrels into a hickory nut. With shouts of barbaric enjoyment, they began to plunder the cargo. Ignoring the barrels of flour and sides of bacon, they pounced upon the Union-issue clothing and boots they needed so desperately. A loud hissing came from the escaping steam. On the deck, two Union soldiers lay dead as mackerels, one with most of his head blown off. In the captain's cabin, they found whiskey, rock candy, and cigars. Jeff pocketed a handful of the cigars for Heifer. Fields was scooping handfuls of federal greenbacks out of a small iron safe. Apparently the boat had been carrying the Fort Gibson payroll, as well as cargo. Every rebel in the cabin had both hands full of money. Yancey Pearl, a tall, raw-boned Arkansasian, shoved some into Jeff's hands. Gaping, Jeff saw that they were $20 bills.
"Here you are, kid," Pearl guffawed, a lighted cigar from the captain's locker between his stained, jagged teeth. "Washington wallpaper. It's yours to play with. It ain't gonna buy nothing now. We's gonna win the war. Just as well throw it away."
Pearl twisted the wad of federal banknotes in his horny hands, tearing them down the middle. He pitched them out the broken cabin window into the river. One by one, the other rebels tore their greenbacks in fragments or ignited them with their cigars and tossed them over the boat's side. Pearl towered impatiently over Jeff.
"Come on, kid. What you waiting on? Rip 'em in two and heave 'em into the drink. They're no good."
Jeff swallowed indecisively. They had a lot of nerve running down good Union money when their own cheap specie wouldn't buy a couple of bites of hot gingerbread. $300 or $400 worth of perfectly good federal greenbacks in his hands was enough to buy a farm or pay his way through college. Jeff saw Fields staring at him, his hard blue eyes ablaze with new suspicion. With reluctance, he hurled all his banknotes overboard. They floated for a moment upon the tan eddy, then slowly sank from sight. The rebels moved the steamboat to the south shore and began to unload her cargo on the sand. A doctor was examining the handful of rebel wounded lying on the grassy bank beneath a cottonwood tree. Among them was Hooley. He had caught a federal mini-ball low in the stomach, and the surgeon attending him looked grim. Distressed, Jeff dropped the armload of booty he had acquired for the Jackmans, blankets, shawls, sugar, and Union coffee, and hurried to Hooley's side. Hooley's brown, inscrutable Indian face was clenched in pain. He was half-sitting, his arms braced behind him, and his short legs stuck out helplessly, revealing the ragged soles of his broken boots. The muddy water dripped off him onto the sand. He had lost his hat. His long black hair was waving in the morning breeze. He glanced up at Jeff. Perspiration was beading on his forehead. He was breathing fast.
"Jefferson," he mumbled, "give me a drink out of your canteen. I want to see if I got any leaks."
Jeff carefully held his canteen to Hooley's lips. It never occurred to him that Hooley was a rebel and therefore his enemy. For 3 months they had knocked around together. Wadey's surgeon stopped most of the bleeding, but he had to do better than that. Everybody knew there would be hundreds of Federals after them. Scowling, the surgeon stood, wiping his bloody hands on his shirt. He looked pityingly at Hooley.
"It's 100 miles to the hospital back at Boggy. You'd have to ride horseback. Think you can make it?"
Hooley was suffering now, panting faster and grunting every time the pain hit him. Angrily, he glared up at the doctor.
"Hell no!"
They moved him out into the sun where the light was better. The surgeon gave him a drink of whiskey, then handed him a lead bullet to bite. With men holding him forcibly on both sides, the surgeon quickly produced a scalpel, sterilized it with whiskey, and extracted the bullet, which was lodged against his abdominal wall. Jeff couldn't watch it. He walked off to one side, leaning against the trunk of a big walnut tree, listening to Hooley groan and curse while the surgeon worked. Twice Hooley yelled out and struggled helplessly, and each time Jeff felt so sorry for him he wanted to bawl. In 3 or 4 minutes, it was all over, and the crowd began to clear. The wound was swabbed with whiskey, and Jeff gave most of his shirt tail for a bandage that the doctor first sterilized by holding close to a fire. Then they put Hooley on his horse. He rode 0.5 mile in the heat and fainted, whereupon Jeff mounted behind him and held him on with both hands while Heifer and Pearl, riding ahead, took turns leading Jeff's horse. They camped that night near Limestone Prairie. Most of the Indian troops, their ponies heavily burdened with spoils from the steamboat, broke camp and headed for the homes of their destitute families in the refugee camps along the Red River. Jeff was puzzled. Wadey seemed to know or care very little about military discipline, and his men reflected his attitude. "What held them together and kept them going?" Jeff asked Heifer.
"Depends on what you mean by discipline."
Heifer blew his nose loudly.
"We ain't got no West Point discipline. Wadey's a Indian. He's educated, Christian, and well-to-do. But he's still a Indian. He uses Indian discipline. Indians believe in taking booty. Makes them fight better. Wadey fights better when he fights his own way. He took the steamboat, didn't he?"
The steamboat wasn't the only thing Wadey took. September came, and the scarlet sumac began to stain the sides of the ridges. Cicadas led the heat chant from the trees. Steve Hildebrand, Wadey's chief of scouts, learned while ranging in federal territory north of Fort Gibson that a big federal wagon train was coming by land from Fort Scott, Kansas. He sent one of his men speeding horseback to Wadey with the news. Wadey notified General Richard M. Gano, an able Texas cavalry officer. With a combined force of 2,000 men, Gano and Wadey struck the Union train and its 670-man escort at Cabin Creek, capturing the train and its mule-drawn cargo valued at $1,500,000. It was the greatest disaster of the war to Union arms in the Indian country. Most of the captured stores were distributed among the needy refugee families along Red River. The rebel morale soared sky-high. The Confederate general, Sterling Price, had started his diversionary raid toward St. Louis, and there was serious talk of a weighty raid upon Kansas in the spring. That sobered Jeff as though somebody had hurled a dipper of cold spring water in his face. His family lived in Kansas and would be squarely in the path of the proposed raid. He worried about that all the way back from Cabin Creek. He didn't want a weighty raid hitting his father's farm. He drove back one of the captured federal wagons, bringing with him blankets, shawls, sugar, and Union coffee for the Jackmans, and a little bit of everything for Hooley, who had survived the long horseback ride from Pheasant Bluff and was recovering in the hospital at Boggy Depot. Arriving at Boggy Depot shortly before noon, he unhitched the big black Union mules, watered them, unharnessed them, and staked them out to graze. Walking to a nearby creek, he stripped off his dirty clothing, took a bath, and felt refreshed. The things he had brought back for the Jackmans in a wooden barrel were left at the supply depot where Heifer had arranged for a teamster friend to drop them off at the Jackmans' home on his return trip down the Texas road to Bonham. The town was filling with rebel soldiers and excited civilians, dancing jigs of joy in the street. All they talked about was Wadey's victories at Pheasant Bluff and Cabin Creek. Jeff went to his bunk and pulled it into the shade. Lying down upon it, he buried his face in his arms. He was awakened by somebody kicking the soles of his boots. It was the orderly sergeant.
"Field say report to him in half an hour, mounted and armed."
Jeff stretched and sat up. He looked at the sun and at the slant of the dark tree shadows. It was early afternoon. Resignedly, he got to his feet and, walking to the commissary wagon, took a long drink from Heifer's gourd dipper. Then he splashed his face with cool water. He put on his hat, cleaned, and loaded his pistol, and saddled Flea Bite. Mounting, he rode to Fields' tent, ducking from side to side to escape the tree branches. Other troopers joined him. Fields was lacing on a federal boot taken from the captured Union supply train. He looked up sourly.
"Special duty," he snarled in his petulant, high-pitched voice. "Let's go."
When they formed in column, Jeff found himself part of a 20-man rebel escort. Accompanied by a single, empty, mule-drawn wagon, they started northwest on the little-used Wapanucka Road. Fields rode ahead with Colonel Thompson, commander of the 2nd Cherokee Regiment and acting treasurer of the Southern Cherokee Nation. They traveled at a swinging trot, mostly in silence. The gravelly trail meandered in and out of clumps of roadside timber. Both men and horses began to perspire. From every tree, cicadas sang shrilly and maddeningly. The piercing chant of one approaching before the stridulations of another had fallen behind. Yellow flowering weeds covered the dusty, heat-locked countryside. An hour before sundown, they halted on the bank of Clear Boggy Creek. There, beneath a towering cottonwood, stood a heavy green Conestoga wagon and a team of big gray mules. Half a dozen men, each well mounted, heavily armed, and wearing blue uniforms of the Union cavalry, clustered watchfully around the wagon, obviously guarding its contents. Jeff attached no significance to the color of their uniforms. Half the men in Wadey's command had abandoned their own shaggy garments for blue uniforms taken at Cabin Creek. One of the strangers, apparently the leader, swaggered forward, confronting Colonel Thompson.
"General Wadey?"
When Jeff heard the querulous voice, he stopped breathing, every instinct sharp and alert. Instantly he knew the tall, stooping figure with the low, graying sideburns, the scar on his cheek, and the wild, suspicious eyes. Clardy.
"I'm Colonel Thompson, treasurer of the Cherokee Nation. General Wadey has empowered me to act for him and for the nation. I have come prepared. Are you ready to deal with us?"
The reply didn't satisfy Clardy. Angrily, he stepped back. His hand dropped to the butt of the pistol holstered in his belt. He flicked his nervous green eyes distrustfully over Thompson and then over the rebel patrol, as though suspecting treachery.
"I'll deal with nobody but Wadey."
He looked at the sun low in the west and scowled.
"I said noon. Where is he?"
Thompson replied politely.
"General Wadey is out on scout, but we expect him back tonight."
Jeff's heart was pounding in panic. He ducked so that his hat brim would hide his face. He knew now that his long wait to learn the identity of the federal officer selling the contraband repeating rifles was over. Clardy glared at Thompson. He seemed to be making an effort to conceal his temper. Reluctantly, he growled,
"I guess we can deal. You got the gold?"
Thompson nodded and started to say something, but Clardy cut him short.
"Order your men to stand back farther. They're looking down our throats."
Thompson looked at him queerly, but gave the order. This was fortunate for Jeff. He turned Fleabite around and walked her back with the others. All except Fields. Hands on his hips, Fields stayed where he was, looking coolly into Clardy's Conestoga wagon. Clardy gestured toward the sergeant.
Him too.
Fields grinned savagely and shook his head. Clardy's henchmen moved ominously forward. Jeff saw that each of them carried a Spencer rifle. Fields fingered his pistol and stood his ground.
That's Sergeant Fields, our gunsmith. I want him to examine the rifles before I pay you for them, Thompson said civilly.
Apparently satisfied, Clardy turned, barking an order to his followers. Four of them climbed off their horses and, reaching into the back of the Conestoga wagon beneath a canvas tarp, hauled out several long boxes. The other two held the reins and kept a sharp watch on the rebel patrol. They all looked like thugs. Jeff didn't recognize any of them. Using the butts of their carbines, Clardy's men broke open the boxes, and Jeff saw row upon row of shiny new repeating rifles, packed flat in sawdust.
While Fields came forward and personally examined each weapon, working the finger levers and inspecting the apertures built into the butts of the walnut stalks, Thompson spread a blanket on the grass. He walked over to his clay bank and returned with two heavy saddlebags. They were the same ones Boudinot had carried into Wadey's tent.
Pop-eyed, Jeff saw the gold coins gleam brightly in the sunshine and heard their metallic chink as Clardy and Thompson counted them on the blanket. Then Clardy scooped the gold into his saddlebag and stood. Fields barked an order, and several rebels came forward to help place the Spencers back in the boxes and load them into the empty wagon they had brought from Boggy Depot. Thompson turned inquiringly to Fields.
How many, Sam?
Fields' face shone triumphantly.
200 even, Connell. Cartridges come out even, too. It's all here. Prettiest sight I ever seed.
When can you let us have the 800 additional rifles Colonel Wadey sent word to you we would buy?
Thompson asked Clardy.
Clardy swore violently. In 2 months, if you'll lay off our wagon train so we can get them through. But the price is going to be higher next time.
There was a moment of deadly silence in the clearing. For the first time, Thompson's voice was edged with hostility.
How much higher?
As he hefted the heavy saddlebags of gold into the back of the Conestoga wagon, Clardy looked shrewdly at Thompson.
That's between me and Wadey. That's why I want to talk to him privately. I want you to bring Wadey here to me.
Thompson stared at him, saying nothing. Bold, insolent, and unafraid, Clardy stared back, a sneer on his thin lips. He knew that he and his $12,000 in gold were safe as a church. The rebels needed those other 800 rifles too badly, and he alone could get them for them.
"Why don't you come into Boggy with us and wait for General Wadey yourself?" Thompson bargained.
"You could wait at my tent. It's next to the general's. It'll be dark, and you'll be safe. Nobody there will know you.
Half our men are wearing Union uniforms. You could start back north later tonight."
It seemed to make sense to Clardy. He gave a surly nod. Ignoring his followers, he reached beneath the canvas tarp and pulled out the bulging saddlebags. Staggering a little under their weight, he walked over to his bay horse and buckled the saddlebags on it. He swung into the saddle and, picking up the reins, joined Thompson at the front of the rebel column. Fields mounted his horse and sat grinning sardonically down at Clardy's followers, doomed to a long wait. He snorted with grim amusement.
"I see he's taking the loot with him. Don't trust you, does he? Well, I don't blame him. So long, you bloody-minded shackpokes. See you again someday."
And turning his horse deliberately, he joined the patrol. The darker it grew, the safer Jeff felt from discovery. He was alternately elated and depressed. Now the trap was ready to spring.
All he had to do was slip through the rebel pickets and ride back to Fort Gibson and tell the Union commander what he had seen and heard. They would catch Clardy red-handed. It was odd how his Union friends back at Fort Gibson seemed almost like strangers. All the way back to Boggy Depot, he rode tight-jawed and silent, fighting it out in his mind for the 100th time. He was thinking hard and sweating hard. His hands were shaking as they held the reins. Half a mile from Boggy Depot, he relaxed suddenly and let his breath out slowly in one long, weary exhalation. He had finally made up his mind. It was time to leave Stand Watie. He didn't want to, and he knew it. At headquarters, Fields dismissed them. Jeff walked to the commissary wagon. Heifer was gone. He unsaddled Fleabite, led her to the creek for water, then tied her loosely to a wheel of the commissary wagon, where she would have plenty of room to graze. Heifer would find her there. Reluctantly, he fondled the little mare's soft ears, his throat suddenly tight. He knew he would never see her again. He hated to leave her, but he couldn't run off to Fort Gibson on the horse Heifer had given him. He couldn't take the saddle, either. Sighing, he lifted it into the back of the commissary wagon, passing his hand fondly over its smooth leather seat. He would take a horse and saddle from the inexhaustible rebel remuda at the camp's south border and leave 2 hours after sundown. He would be a long way up the Texas road before daybreak. He felt like a thief, but he couldn't explain it to Heifer. Heifer was a rebel. With time on his hands, Jeff took one last walk uptown. In spite of the dull misery in his heart, he felt calm and relieved at last. He was glad to have the struggle over with. Boots clopping on the flagstone sidewalk, he neared the hotel. He heard the squeak of a fiddle and the tinkle of gay, feminine laughter. Sounded like one of the starvation dances the rebels sometimes held. He walked onto the hotel's plank front porch and looked curiously into the open front door, a rectangle of yellow light. The place was crowded. The dance seemed some sort of celebration of the rebel victory at Cabin Creek. In the lobby were rebel officers in worn, frazzled uniforms, waltzing with girls in patched-up, made-over hoop skirts. The officers wore spurs, and when they danced, the spurs jingled rhythmically with the fiddle music. Everybody seemed to be having a gay time.
"Excuse us, sir."
Jeff spun around. Behind him, a girl stood smiling. She was a pretty girl. A band of black velvet encircled her brown throat. A brooch swung at her neck. Clad in a hoop skirt with pink crosswise ruffles, she was necessarily taking up lots of room on the porch. A tall, blonde rebel lieutenant stood stiffly at her side. Obviously, they wished to enter. Moving back, Jeff's eyes followed her in the half-light. At the same time, she looked full at him, and her small round mouth parted with astonishment. She gave a low cry of pleasure.
"Jeff!"
Jeff was so wonder-stricken he nearly fell off the porch. The girl standing before him was Lucy Washburn. Chapter 23 The Redbud Tree.
"Lucy!"
Jeff breathed her name with a whistling gasp of surprise. She took both his hands tightly in hers. Then her eyes dropped to Jeff's clothing. He was wearing what was unmistakably a pair of rebel gray cavalry pants. Moreover, he was roaming free and unmolested in the heart of the Southern Indian military headquarters. To Lucy, that could mean but one thing. She gave a low cry of ecstasy. Insensible to all else, Jeff could only stand there on the hotel porch and stare at her, his nerves thrumming like a guitar string. Lucy was the first to recover from the shock of their meeting. Skirt swishing, she spun around lightly, facing her escort.
"Lieutenant Chavis, Mr. Bussey."
For once, Jeff forgot to salute. He only nodded mechanically, caring not a whit for the rebel lieutenant, his rank, nor his presence.
Lieutenant, could you possibly excuse me for a moment?
Lucy said sweetly.
I will join you later on the floor.
The rebel lieutenant frowned. Plainly he didn't like it. But he bowed, mumbled something, and stepped back. Still holding Jeff's hand, she led him off the porch and around the side of the building. There the heart-shaped leaves of a small redbud tree screened them from sight. To his astonishment, she came lightly, eagerly into his arms and, standing on tiptoe, put up her lovely mouth. As their lips met and his arms went around her waist, he felt a blissful melting within him, an overpowering rapture that he had never known nor dreamed existed. For a moment there was no sound, save that of their quick breathing and the leaves of the redbud tree soughing gently as the warm south wind stirred them. He could feel Lucy's warm, pliant body trembling.
"Lucy," he murmured, "I've been wild to see you. I've thought about you every single day."
Her soft arms were around his neck, and her eyes were shut. He forgot all about the war. He forgot all about Clardy, the repeating rifles, or returning to the Union lines.
"Oh, Jeff," she whispered, "I've been so worried about you. It's been 14 months since I saw you last."
As he held her close, Jeff's lips caressed her eyebrow, her cheek, her ear. He could feel her heart pounding beneath her bodice. This was something he never wanted to forget. A sweet miracle that couldn't happen again in 10,000 years. How wrong he had been to think Lucy didn't like him. Although she had her pick of all the swains and gallants in Wadey's brigade, she was giving her heart to him, and making a rebel lieutenant wait inside while she did it. Her eyes, soft and brown as pansies, were bright with emotion. A year and a half ago, he wouldn't have dared hope she would even speak to him. And now, here she was, in his arms. Her hand slipped down to his collar, absently tracing the button on his shirt.
"I've been worried to distraction about you," she said, feelingly. "I asked Belle Listenby to try to find out from Fort Gibson where you were all this time, but all she could learn was that you had gone on scout and were several months overdue."
Her low, melodious voice, resonant as a deep-toned church bell, was vibrant with concern. Sighing, she leaned back and looked up at him.
"How tall you've grown, Jeff. I even asked Father to try to find you at the prisoner camp at Tyler when he went south to Texas several months ago. Then we left Tahlequah and refugeed south ourselves, and I lost all trace of you. Until now."
Tears were on her cheek.
"Jeff, to find you here in the Army of the South is a pleasure I never hoped to see. Tell me, what made you decide to join us?"
A cold, chilling breeze blew through him. He looked at her and felt the blood surging to the roots of his hair. What a fool he had been. Lucy believed he had switched to the rebel side. No wonder her greeting had been so ardent. He released her, his pulses pounding dully with despair. Tired of the subterfuge he had been living, he decided to tell her everything and get it over with.
"Lucy, I hate hurting you, but now I've got to. I'm not in the Southern Army the way you think I am. I'm a Union scout, out of uniform, behind the lines."
She stiffened and, in the yellow half-light of the window, regarded him with dazed wonder. He told her how Bostwick's spur-of-the-moment remark had unwittingly enrolled both of them in the Wadey cavalry, and how Bostwick had been killed at Honey Springs. He told her how, despite his illness, he had warned Blunt that Steele and Bankhead were moving on Fort Gibson. Plunging resolutely on, he spoke of his own illness and the Jackmans, and about Clardy's clandestine sale of the smuggled rifles. He described his enforced service with the rebel Cherokee cavalry, what fine comrades they were, and how much he had grown to like them. and when he told her of his fierce inner struggle, whether to go back to the fort or cast his lot wholeheartedly with Huli Heifer and all his new friends, the color came back a little into her face, and her dark eyes kindled with hope. Earnestly, she put her hand on his arm.
"Then join us, Jeff," she implored. "We're going to win, Jeff. I feel sure of it. We have been winning lately, you know."
There it was, as plain as though this strong, intense rebel girl had written it herself on a blackboard. If he stayed with the South, he would have Lucy. If he returned to Fort Gibson, he would probably never see her again. Now he had his decision to make all over again, and this time it was more agonizing than ever. He had to decide for all time between having Lucy or staying with his country, and he had to decide quickly. The thoughts tumbled wildly through his mind. His chest felt heavy. He saw that she was waiting, her face white.
"Lucy, I'm going back to the fort. I know my country has been wrong about a lot of things and that your people are fighting for their national existence, but Lucy, I'm just like you. I can't go back on my country or my state. In Kansas, we're fighting for our existence, too. We're fighting to clean up the murders and bushwhacking over slavery and for the right to decide the kind of state we want without the ballots being rigged by thousands of Missourians crossing the line to vote or steal from us or shoot us down. It's a nationwide fight now, and I think the only way it can ever be settled is for the North to subdue the South."
He guessed it sounded oratorical, but he had said it the best he could. He looked miserably down at her. His voice grew soft with longing.
"I'm crazy about you, Lucy. You know that. I wanted us to be married someday and live together always. I know this means I've probably lost you forever, but it's the thing I've got to do."
Lucy's small oval chin lifted proudly. She stepped to one side so he could pass. Stricken, Jeff looked once at her, then walked quickly away.
"Jeff!"
She ran lightly to him. Crying softly, she came again into his arms, hiding her head against his breast. When her emotion had subsided and she raised her face, Jeff saw she had surrendered completely. All her fierce pride and violent patriotism was gone. For the first time in her life, she forgot the war and all its issues. She loved him, and that was all that mattered. Swiftly, she kissed him. Her eyes were large with fright.
"Goodbye, Jeff. I hope you get away. Please be careful. I'll think about you every day until I see you again."
"I'll come back and get you after the war, Lucy. Will you wait for me?"
"I'll wait," she promised.
"It may be kind of a long wait. In the morning, they may figure out why I left. If they do, they'll be after me. If they catch me, they'll hang me so high I could look down on the moon." He looked at her fondly.
"Goodbye, Lucy,"
he said, kissing her cheek. For a moment she clung to him, then she let him go, watching his straight young body disappear from sight in the darkness. Even when she couldn't see him anymore, she waited until his quick footsteps died away completely on the flagstone walk. Then she turned and walked slowly back into the hotel. Jeff decided to go first to his tent on the camp's outskirts and put food in his saddlebags. Hurrying, he saw ahead the headquarters tent with its fire blazing and its Betty lamps flickering brightly outside it. He would have to pass that way, but there was no risk because the sentries knew him. Nobody knew he was leaving, and when they missed him in the morning, they still probably wouldn't know why he had left or where he had gone. He clenched his fists with satisfaction. If he stayed on the Texas road and kept his eyes open, he shouldn't have any problems. He should be north of Limestone Gap by daybreak. Then he could cut straight across, riding into the fort by nightfall of the second day. He didn't see the lone, fretful figure pacing the darkness outside Thompson's tent until he almost collided with it. Startled, the man gasped and cursed.
"Excuse me, sir," Jeff stammered, the light full on his face.
"Pussy!"
Jeff recoiled and felt the blood draining from his cheeks. It was Clardy. His mind busy with plans for his flight and with sweet thoughts of Lucy, he had forgotten all about the Union captain. Instantly, he knew all his plans had collapsed and his life was in danger. Clardy would tell Thompson that he was a Union spy. Thompson would check with Fields. Fields would remember that Jeff had been with a patrol that saw Clardy unload the rifles. In a few short moments, the rebels would be after him like 40 hen hawks after a setting quail. They had to take him before he reached Fort Gibson, or they'd never get their 800 rifles. Desperate, Jeff put his hand on his pistol. He had a lightning impulse to kill Clardy on the spot. Instead, he ducked into the hazel brush and began running toward the horse lot, 200 yards away. Behind him, he could hear Clardy shouting for the sentries. From the rack outside the horse lot, Jeff grabbed up a saddle, a bridle, and a blanket. Aware of his deadly peril, he tried desperately to salvage what he could from the disastrous situation. Carrying the saddle, he ran awkwardly and felt his riding boots chafe his feet. Now the whole camp was in an uproar. Jeff heard Fields bawling orders. Weighed down with the heavy saddle, Jeff tried to run faster. Suddenly he heard hoofbeats approaching at a gallop. Somebody, probably Fields, was thinking lightning fast in the crisis. Digging his boot heels into the ground, Jeff slid to a stop. They had cut him off from the horses. Frustrated and panting, he looked wildly around him in the dark. Of all the rotten luck! Now he was on foot with the whole rebel camp alarmed and looking for him, and Fort Gibson was 125 miles away. Fighting down his panic, he dropped the saddle and the blanket but kept the bridle. Maybe he could find or take a horse on the way. If not, he would have to walk, and his riding boots would be useless. He spun around and, sprinting back to his tent, grabbed up a pair of old infantry shoes. He scooped up two handfuls of shelled corn and filled his pockets. There wasn't time to take anything else. Hearing voices and the sentries' running footsteps approaching, he ran from the tent into the timber, thankful for the darkness that would hide him until dawn. Chapter 24 Flight. Tying his shoes around his neck, Jeff hurried toward the thickest part of the woods. He knew there would be fewer pickets there. His eyes quickly became adjusted to the darkness. Staying in the heavy timber, he soon put the noise of the aroused camp behind him. He tried to calculate where his pursuers would look for him first. Probably the last direction they would expect him to go would be south, toward Texas. So he headed south, walking fast. After he'd gone a mile or two, he planned to cut straight east, 10 or 12 miles, toward Arkansas, then head northeast, cross the Gaines Creek Mountains and the Limestone Mountains to the fort. They would be after him at sunup from all directions. Without a horse, the odds were heavily against him. He had to have a horse. His feet began to hurt, and he stopped and changed to his shoes. All he could hear was the whippoorwills cooing softly from the trees. Circling to the east, he came into a clearing and saw the red glow of the moon rising through the dark timber. It reminded him of the prairie fires he used to watch in Kansas at night. Now he could see everything more plainly. He was carrying his boots and the bridle. In his belt he wore the hunting knife and double-barreled pistol Heifer had given him. After he had walked south a couple of miles, he bore straight east toward the rising moon, which had now cleared the treetops. He knew he had passed the last of the rebel pickets and had nothing to fear the rest of the night. It was the daylight he dreaded. Then the pick of Wadey's men would be on his trail, men who could ride and track and knew the country and the people living in it. Jeff wondered where the Fort McCulloch Road was. If he was calculating correctly, he should cross it at any time. 15 minutes later, he saw its ruts gleaming darkly in the moonlight. Praise God, it looked empty. He listened carefully. From the grass clumps, the katydids were singing their sad, bittersweet songs, as though lamenting the passing of summer. A coyote wailed lonesomely from the hills. But that was all. Jeff felt a yearning and a discouragement that was almost intolerable. His thoughts kept straying back with pleasant melancholy to Lucy. At best, he wouldn't see her again for several long months, and if the rebels ever caught him, his courting days would be over forever. He felt for his pistol. Clardy, who sat in on all of Blunt's staff meetings, would know about the message Lehman Jones had carried to Fort Gibson. He would quickly acquaint Wadey with the details. The rebels had more than one score to settle with Jeff. He crossed the road and plunged into the timber on the other side. Tired of carrying the bridle, he tied it around his shoulders and under his arms. When he ran, he could feel the bridle's steel bit spanking him in the small of the back, but he didn't care. He wanted to get back to the fort. He was unencumbered by baggage, and fear lent wings to his feet. When the whippoorwills ceased marking the time and the owls took it up, Jeff struck a large creek which he judged to be Clear Boggy. The air was cool along the creek bottom. Taking off his shoes, he stayed in the water for 3 or 4 miles, splashing southeastward through the shallows or wading down the middle through the deep, cool mud. He knew there would probably be dogs on his trail in the morning. He aimed to make their work as difficult as possible. When the moon began to drop behind him, Jeff left the creek, put on his dry shoes and stockings, and began to walk northeastward again. He was growing tired, but doggedly he kept going. He had to keep moving until he found a horse. In the eastern sky, the moonlight revealed a few white fleecy clouds floating motionless like long films of cobwebs. When finally they began to turn darker and the stars around them to burn more sharply, he knew it was time to hole up. He figured the best way to avoid being seen was to travel at night and sleep in the woods in the daytime. Half an hour before sunrise, he crawled into a plum thicket. Taking his knife and pistol out of his belt and placing them on the ground beside him, he lay down with his hat over his eyes. Dozing off, he slept fitfully. He dreamed he was hidden in a tall tree overlooking the commissary wagon in the rebel camp back at Boggy. Heifer was serving huge plates of ham and fried potatoes to Fields, Wadey, Thompson, and Clardy. Perishing from hunger, Jeff was about to crawl down out of the tree and give himself up, begging for one good meal before they called the firing squad, when oddly, somebody began to throw cold water in his face. Awakened by a growl of thunder, he opened his eyes to find the sky was overcast and big raindrops were hitting him in the face. They plunked softly through the plum leaves above him. A big black cloud was rolling out of the west, darkening everything. The wind was blowing fresh and cool from the north and smelled of rain. Sweeping up his knife, pistol, and boots, he dove under a tree for shelter. Then the storm broke. He thrust his loaded pistol into one of his boots to keep the two loads dry. They were all the ammunition he had. All afternoon long he sat drearily in the downpour, listening to the raindrops monotonously peppering his hat brim. The water ran off his hat onto his arms and shoulders, chilling him. The wind came up, plastering the wet grass to the muddy ground. Hungry, he chewed some of the shelled corn in his pocket. As soon as it grew dark, he began walking again. It rained nearly all night. It was slower going now. He was tired. Clouds hid the moon. The ground was slick, and the mud balled up beneath his shoes. Dawn caught him halfway through a big patch of hazel brush. He was just falling asleep in it when he heard the sound of a horse's hoofs striking the stony ground. Thinking it might be a loose horse, he reached for the bridle he had brought along. Then, squinting through the brush, he felt his blood freeze in his veins. He didn't need any bridle. He wasn't going any place except maybe back to Boggy Depot. Several mounted men, all heavily armed, rode toward him. They were rebels. Two black dogs that looked like Newfoundlands walked ahead, sniffing the earth. Jeff wondered how they had traced him so fast. Probably by his tracks in the mud. He gulped in despair. This was it. They had him. He flattened himself on the ground and began to pray hard. 100 yards away, the dogs entered the brush and came toward him. The men followed. They came closer and closer. Suddenly a man laughed.
"Ha! Thar you are, Bussy. I see you. Come on out of thar, or I'll shoot you full of buckshot."
Jeff heard him cock the trigger. His heart hammering with fear, Jeff lay too frightened to move. His pistol was in his hand. Carefully weighing his chances, he wondered if he could catch the horse after he shot the nearest man off it.